Okay, so today is December 20th, 2014. Okay, so let us begin with a homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. And today we'll be taking for study the sutta number 124 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Bakula Sutta. It's a discourse with a monk named Bakula. And as I mentioned last week, if you want to see the way Bakula is depicted, at least in the Chinese tradition, when you walk up the what's called the Bodhi Path, that's the stone walk going from the parking lot to the big Buddha hall, you see along the sides of the path there are statues of 18 arahats. And on the left side, could be somewhere around the sixth or seventh up, you'll see one figure with a short beard sort of staring out like this, his head turned to one side, and on his side there's a fierce looking animal that looks something like a cross between a lioness and a bulldog. And that is supposed to be the Venerable Bakula. And amongst the foremost disciples of the Buddha, that is, the Buddha appointed different monks, nuns, male lay disciples, female lay disciples. He established a number of categories and then appointed from his circle of disciples the foremost disciple in each area. And Venerable Bakula was appointed the foremost disciple with respect to good health. So if you want to get healthy, if you have health problems, or you want to assure yourself of good health, you can go Namo Bakula, Bakulasa Te Rasa, homage to the elder Bakula. Okay, according to the commentary, the name Bakula means two families. The word two in Pali is actually dve, and the word for family is kula. But sometimes, I think because Pali is based on vernacular languages, the word dve gets turned into ba. And so when you have ba plus kula, you get two families. And the commentary gives a background story, to explain how Bakula got that name. And as I often say about commentarial stories, when I relate them in class, I usually cross my fingers and keep them under the desk or behind my back. And so you could do the same as you're listening. Okay, according to the story, okay, Bakula was born into a good family, I think someplace upriver from Benares, Varanasi. And then after he was born, one day when his nurse took him to the river to bathe, she placed him in the river and she was bathing him, and then some kind of fierce fish, maybe like a shark, so I don't know whether they have sharks in the river Ganges, but some fierce fish came down the river, and she became frightened and she lost her grip on the boy, and he went floating down the river. And so she had to report to the family that she had lost the son, and of course they were upset. But it happened that a big fish swimming in the river saw Bakula, this young boy, and took him to be some delicious meal and swallowed him. But because Bakula had a lot of merits from previous lives, he wasn't chewed by the fish, but the fish just swallowed him in one gulp and got him down into its belly. And Bakula remained there through the force of his merit and his spiritual power. Okay, then as the fish continued to swim downriver, it came to Benares, and then a fisherman caught the fish, big fish, and sold it to a housewife in Benares. And as she took this big fish and was preparing to cook it, she cut it open and pulled it open. And of course, the housewife and her husband, for a long time, they had been trying to have a child. They had never succeeded. Now, they cut open the big fish and pulls open the belly. And what does she find inside but a beautiful young boy, body fully intact, alive, and she thinks like this is her blessing for some past merits. And so she takes out the young boy and she tells her husband, "My dear, we have a son who was born to us in the belly of a fish." Okay, and so they started to bring up the boy, and then of course they told their neighbors, and then word spread, and it spreads from one family to another, going all the ways up river, till the original family up the river hears that this family in Benares had bought a fish from a fisherman, and inside was a little baby boy. And so they realize that must be our son. And so they go down to Benares, and then they inquire, where is that family that found the baby boy inside the belly of a fish? And eventually they are directed to this household. So they come to the family and they say, "Oh," they see the little boy and say, "Oh, that is our son. He belongs to us." But the family that adopted the boy that took it out from the fish said, "No, we got this boy from the belly of a fish. It's ours." And so they quarreled and disputed. And finally, the two families went together to the king of Benares and reported their conflict. And the king said, "Well, you both have sound reasons for considering the boy to be your own. So to settle the conflict, let's say that he belongs to both families. So he's a two-family son." And so they worked out an arrangement whereby for 4 months the boy would remain with one family. Then after 4 months he would go over to the other, they would bring him down to the other family. They would nurture him for 4 months. Then after 4 months, bring him back to the first family. And so in this way, the boy was nurtured by two families. And even when he reached maturity, he had built for himself two residences, one on the property of the first family, another on the residence at the residence of the other family, and he would pass his time alternating between the two residences. By this time, he was a wealthy young man. He would be accompanied by his, according to the commentary, the dancing girls. Whoops. And according to the commentary, he spent 80 years living in this way, till in his 80th year, he encountered the Buddha's teaching. He heard the Dhamma, I guess from the Blessed One, the Buddha, and then he decided to go forth and he became a monk. Okay, now this sutta, if we take a look even at the first paragraph, we say, thus have I heard, on one occasion the Venerable Bakula was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove, the squirrel's sanctuary. Do you notice anything peculiar in this first paragraph, this opening paragraph? Wait, I haven't come to that yet. Just the first few sentences.
It doesn't state the Blessed
One. Exactly, exactly. Usually the beginning of the suttas, even when they concern some other monk, it will say that on this one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at, could be Rajgir, or Savati. Yeah, I'm just taking as an example sutta number 127. It's on page 1002. You see it begins, thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Savati and Jeta's Grove, and not the Pindika's Park. Okay, then the rest of the sutta, there's no mention of the Buddha at all. It all takes place as a conversation between the monk, Venerable Anuruddha, and a carpenter named Panchakanga. And then there's another monk who's drawn into the conversation, but no further mention of the Buddha. But because it takes place while the Buddha was alive, it refers to the Buddha in the opening paragraph. But this sutta takes place, when this sutta opens, there's no mention of the Buddha at all. And if Bakula went forth when he was 80 years old, and later on, a few sentences down in the sutta, it says that the Venerable Bakula had gone forth, had been a monk now for 80 years. So first this would imply that he was 160 years old at the time the sutta takes place, which is probably the reason why he is praised as the foremost in good health. And it certainly would have taken place after the Buddha's parinibbana, and in fact, we could be quite certain that this sutta would not have been included in the compilation of the canon or of the text that took place at the first council at Rajgir, supposedly 3 months or 6 months after the Buddha's passing away. But rather, this sutta would have been incorporated into the collection of discourses probably at the time of the second council at Vaisali, perhaps 100 years after the Buddha's passing. Okay, so the sutta begins. It says that a chela kasapa a former companion of the Venerable Bakula in his lay life, went to him and exchanged greetings with him. Then after exchanging greetings, he sat down to one side and he asked a question of the Venerable Bakula. Now it seems to me that this figure, Acela Kassapa, is, I don't know whether we can identify him as a precise historical figure, because the name Acela Kassapa is used in connection with a number of discourses which take place in different places and with quite different settings. The word Acela means one without clothing. In other words, he was a naked ascetic. And there's an Acela Kassapa who questions the Buddha about dependent origination. In Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 12, sutta number 17, he comes to the Buddha and asks whether a sentient being, whether it's the same sentient being who does karma and receives the result, or whether it's a different sentient being who creates karma and receives the result. Then the Buddha answers him in terms of dependent origination, and then this Acela Kassapa gains faith in the Buddha and asks the Buddha for permission to go forth and become a monk. And then the sutta reports that he became a monk, went off and achieved arahatship. Then there's another Acela Kassapa who has a conversation with the householder Citta, the householder, in Samyutta Nikaya, sutta number, it's chapter 41, I don't remember the sutta number. And so it seems that there are a number of naked ascetics called Kassapa, which seems unlikely, or just this figure has been taken somewhat symbolically just to function as a kind of, I don't know, the figurehead, you could say, to serve as somebody who questions a particular member of either the Buddha or a disciple of the Buddha. Okay, so Acela Kassapa now comes and asks the Venerable Bakula, how long is it since you went forth, since you left the household life to become a monk? And Venerable Bakula answers, 80 years since I went forth. So again, as I said, that makes him 160 years of age at this time. Okay, then Acela Kassapa asks a rather mind-blowing question. He says, friend Bakula, in these 80 years, how many times have you engaged in sexual intercourse? So obviously he doesn't, if the question is historical, he doesn't understand anything about the rules of monastic life. But at the time of the Buddha, there were some so-called ascetic communities which weren't pledged to celibacy. For example, there's sutta number, I think it's 45. This is on page 406. No, actually, it's the passage, the full passage on page 405, that in section 3 it says that there are certain recluses and Brahmins, so these are samana, which means ascetics, those who have renounced the worldly life. But their doctrine and view is there is no harm in sensual pleasures, and then they take to gulping down sensual pleasures, and they divert themselves or amuse themselves with women wanderers who have their hair tied in a top knot. And then they say, why do some other ascetics speak about future danger in sensual pleasures? Pleasant is the touch of this woman wanderer's tender, soft, downy arm. Okay, so maybe Acela Kassapa thought that the Buddhist bhikkhus were also followers of this kind of doctrine. And so he asked this, sounds a rather outlandish question, in these 80 years, and he's asking this, an 80-year-old man, how many times did you, since you went forth, did you engage in sexual intercourse? And then Bakula replies to him, you should not ask me such a question, but rather you should ask me this. In these 80 years, how many times have perceptions of sensual desire arisen in you? In other words, how many times have you some perception, has some perception arisen in you in which you would grasp upon the attractive and beautiful features of a woman, and by doing so, this would arouse some kind of thought of sensual desire? Or actually, at this point, it's just some perception, some sensually enticing perception, not yet even the thought of sensual desire. Okay, and then Bakula replies, in the 80 years since I went forth, I do not recall any perception of sensual desire to have ever arisen in me. And now we come to a little paragraph which is inserted into the text. And this would come from the compilers of the discourse. And this passage reads that in the 80 years since he went forth, the Venerable Bakula did not recall any perception of sensual desire to have ever arisen in him. This we remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Venerable Bakula. And when we read this paragraph, we can see, or at least I can notice, two things about this paragraph. One is the use of the expression wonderful and marvelous quality. Does this ring any bell in you?
That's the fully enlightened, or that's the fact that we were reading about last week. I mean, but are they saying that Bakula is fully enlightened also?
Not in the sense of the Buddha, but that's one of the points that I had in mind. To have a wonderful and marvelous quality doesn't mean that one is fully enlightened in the sense of being a sammasambuddha. Bakula, of course, is enlightened in that he's an arhat. But having wonderful and marvelous qualities is not a unique feature of a fully enlightened Buddha. But this is what the point that you brought up is one of the relevant points. And this is that probably the reason why this sutta was placed in this position, following the sutta on the wonderful, marvelous qualities of the Tathagata, is because they both use that expression, wonderful and marvelous qualities. Something else that's interesting about this passage, but maybe it hasn't become clear at this point, but we're going to find this passage is repeated after each section, And I think maybe by the end of the sutta it will become clearer, the kind of, at least from one perspective, the kind of function that is fulfilling. Okay, so first, Bakula says that in these 80 years since he became a monk, he's not aware of having any sensual perception arise in him. Then he continues and says, in these 80 years, I do not recall any perception of ill will, that's anger or hatred, or any perception of cruelty, of harmfulness to have arisen in him. And then after, each of these actually constitutes a separate statement on its own, and each of those separate statements is followed by that repeating passage, the refrain, that this we remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of Venerable Bakula. Okay, then paragraph 6, section 6, Bakula says, in the 80 years since I went forth, I do not recall any thought of sensual desire to have arisen. Then he continues, I do not recall any thought of ill will, any thought of cruelty or harmfulness to have arisen in me. So this is, I think, taking the process of cognition one step further. So often, or at least in various places in the suttas, we find statements to the effect that perception is the basis or condition for thought. So when we perceive in a particular way, that perception or sanya triggers a particular kind of thought or vitakka. Vitakka is what I translate as thought, yeah. And sanya is perception. And so, for example, the sensual perception, okay, the man sees a woman, for example, and you know, first he might notice pleasant smile, bright, shiny eyes, nice flowing hair, nice figure. So those are just perceptions. But underlying them is the tendency to sensual desire. And so once he sort of collects a number of perceptions like that, then a thought of sensual desire could arise in him. And then the thought will motivate action. So you go up and try to think of a nice opening line. Didn't I meet you in Los Angeles last year? Or I don't know, I'm not so clever. Maybe that's why I became a monk. Get away. Idiot. You're so sweet. You've got to do better than that if you want to, to get me. Okay, so sensual perception leads to sensual thoughts. Then, you know, sometimes things in a situation, maybe the way somebody opens his book or sits down in his seat, or just the way they walk, or just the expression on their face, creates, you don't even know the person, but you just get the perception And already there's some kind of, like, your perceptual field starts vibrating. And, you know, it starts flashing red. And then the person continues to start to behave in that way. And then it leads to thoughts of anger and ill will, that you don't like that person. And so this is perception, sort of conditioned by ill will, generating the thoughts of ill will. How it works with cruelty or harmfulness? I don't know. Anybody have any ideas about that? How a perception...
Kill somebody or an animal. The perception comes first, and then you're going to kill it.
Yeah, actually, that's a good idea. Yeah.
But then it's our desires that drive our anger and our.
Well, of course, they're underlying there, but okay. Let's say a guy has gone hunting, and he sees it's the deer hunting season, he sees the deer in the woods, and so maybe he thinks, okay, that's a good target. And then that will motivate the thought of taking up the gun and shooting.
Would the thought lead more to the action, you're saying? In other words, is the action more or less?
Yeah. Well, first, the perception, a particular perception, will generate the thought. And then the thought will lead to the action. Of course, the thought will be then, could trigger, will... sort of technically the thought will then trigger the volition, and then that's the chaitana, and then the chaitana, the volition, is what motivates the action. Okay, so these are the classical formulation for the three types of unwholesome perception and unwholesome thought, that is perception, sensual perception, call this angry perception or perception accompanied by ill will, and perception accompanied by cruelty or harmfulness, the tendency to inflict harm and suffering on others. And Bakula says that since he became a monk, none of these, he doesn't recall any of these having arisen in him. And when he says he doesn't recall this, you know, it's a kind of modest way of saying that it's actually never taken place in him. Okay, now we come to the next section, which is a composite of a number of separate passages, each one of which, we have to remember, occurs in the original as a separate statement. And each one is followed by that sort of round of applause. This is a wonderful and marvelous quality in the Venerable Bakula. Okay, he says, since I went forth, I do not recall ever having accepted a robe from a householder. And then this goes with the next one, ever having worn a robe given by a householder. Okay, now there are two ways in which monks get their robes. Sort of the old ideal, the original ideal in the early days of the Buddha's teaching, was for monks, and even before the Buddha established the monastic sangha, for the ascetics who were wandering over India to just find discarded pieces of cloth, particularly by going to the charnel ground, where they would, when a person dies, sort of like beggars, vagabonds, criminals, you know, people who are not cremated by their families, they would just wrap the body up in a cloth and throw it away in a charnel ground, where the body would be devoured by jackals, and hyenas and crows and other creatures, wild dogs. And so the ascetics would go to the charnel ground and take these pieces of cloth that have been abandoned, and then cut up the pieces, sew them together, and dye them. They would use bark or leaves or wood from the trees, boil the wood and bark to get a dye which is somewhat this color, and then they would put the cloth in and then wear it as their robe. Okay, but when the Buddha was teaching, at a certain point, lay people asked whether they could offer ready-made robes to the monastics. And the Buddha permitted this out of compassion for lay people, so that they could get merits by offering the monks their simple requisites of their robes.
It wasn't because the robes didn't smell so good?
Well, of course, after they got them from the cremation or from the charnel ground, they would wash the robes off in the river or ponds, and then clean them with various cleaning materials, chew them, ground up limestone, and then they would wear them. They wouldn't just put them on right after taking them off the corpse. Okay, but those who wanted to continue to maintain the original ascetic spirit would refuse to accept robes made by householders, and they would insist on continuing to observe the practice of making the robes themselves. In fact, particularly in the forest tradition of Northeast Thailand, the monks still make up their robes. But the cloth is usually off. They don't go to the charnel grounds. But the cloth, the plain white cloth, is usually offered by householders. But the monks become very experienced and master tailors. They know how to cut up the robes into the correct size pieces of cloth, how to sew them together using sewing machines, not threading themselves, and then dyeing the robes themselves. But this monk Bakula, you'll see that he's maintaining the old ascetic ideal, and so he refuses to accept robes from householders, to wear them given by householders. If he sees another monk has a robe that was offered by a householder, and that monk says to Bakula, "Will you accept this robe from me?" Bakula will refuse. He'll only wear robes that he's made up himself from pieces of cloth. Okay, he's never cut a robe with a cutter ever. He's never sewn a robe with a needle.
Yeah, but he doesn't, how he gets them?
Excuse me?
How he gets his robes?
Yeah, that's a good question. Ever having colored a robe with dye? I didn't look at the commentarial explanation of this, but it's a bit problematic.
From another monk?
Excuse me?
Maybe a robe offered by another monk?
It's the only thing I could think of. But then that would be a concession from... Excuse me? Oh, she's asking whether he was naked. No, actually, going naked is prohibited by the Vinaya.
I'm wondering if he's talking about the use of a cutter, the use of a needle, the use of the dye as being luxuries, rather than all the different kinds of tools.
Yeah, perhaps that is the case. Though a needle is included with what's called the eight requisites. So, when anybody is ordained as a monk, they get a parcel or a package with the eight requisites. That's the three basic robes, the belt, it's four, the filter for filtering water, a strainer, water strainer, the razor for shaving. Oh, the alms bowl, of course, the alms bowl, and a needle and thread. Okay, three robes, belt, it's a cloth belt, bowl, alms bowl, strainer, needle and thread, And razor, yeah. Anyway, we can leave this as a mystery. Okay, then he's never sewn a robe at the Gatina time. The Gatina is an event which is held at the end of the rains retreat, the 3-month rains retreat, which usually lasts from the day after the full moon of July till the full moon of October. Then after that, there's a 1-month period in which on a certain day, the monks designate this as the Gatina day, when they take pieces of cloth that have been offered and prepare them into a new robe. And they all work together to prepare that new robe. It has to be prepared within a 24-hour period, so they all work together. But Bakula says that he's never worked on making a robe during the Gatina time, and he's never made robes for his companions in the holy life, or his fellow monks. Yeah.
Is it possible maybe he's alluding to that he realizes there's no self, so there is no I that is making a robe? Could that be it?
Well, don't forget that many of the other monks would be arahats, and they made robes, they worked together with other monks to make robes.
So I'm not sure if that's
yeah.
maybe what...
I don't think so. I think these are all intended to sort of elevate the figure of Bakula as the model of the ascetic practitioner. But certainly, as I was answering Bowie's point, he couldn't have been going naked because that is prohibited, to go in naked in public.
Is it possible that he had been wearing the same robe for all those years?
80 years? And when one is wandering, you know, a good part of the year in tropical climate like India, the robe tends to get sweaty, and so one will be washing the robe fairly regularly.
Some of the clothes from the mummy can last for thousands of years.
Yeah, but that's because the it's being kept underground. You know, it's not being subject to the changing outer conditions.
From the age of 80 to 160, all of us can be very holy. It's only when we are younger that the sensual desires and anger and all this come.
No, we're talking about the robe, not about the mental.
No, I'm saying Bakula.
Yeah, oh. Yeah, so I'm just doubtful that he could have worn the same robe for 80 years. I mean, in Sri Lanka, when I was living in Sri Lanka, you know, where we have to wash the robes fairly regularly because they get sweaty in the climate, a robe can last, okay, 3 or 4 years, even with patches and being re-dyed. Then it turns into bed sheets or towels.
I mean, this is way off, but could he have found a robe somewhere? I mean, he wasn't given to him. He didn't make it up. He didn't sew it.
It seems a little problematic because the Buddha laid down, you know, precise instructions for the design of the robes. Mm-hmm. And so to conform to the model or the pattern that the Buddha laid out, he would have to find a robe that had belonged to a Buddhist monk.
But then that's taking what's not given, and that's why...
Well, if the robe is cast off, it's not considered taking what is not given. Taking what is not given actually means taking something which is the belonging of another.
Well, that was the first question I had when they were picking up the robes from the dead people, the material.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, but still, because it's not considered the property of another, it's not, it doesn't come under the definition of taking what is not given. Mm-hmm. It's considered discarded material.
Maybe there were other ways of fastening the robe.
This I don't know. I think we'll just have to pass this question up, not take further time on it. Okay, now we come to another set of qualities of Bakula. Okay, since in the 80 years since he went forth, or since I went forth, he says, I do not recall ever having accepted an invitation to a meal, ever having given rise to the thought or the wish, oh, may someone invite me to a meal, ever having sat down inside a house, that is a house of lay people, ever having eaten a meal inside a house. Okay, now for the monastic order, there are various ways that the Buddha has laid down for the monastics to receive their meals. Okay, one way is to stay at the monastery. Then lay people will bring food to the monastery and then offer the food in the monastery to the monks and nuns. Another way, which is sort of the ideal way, held up as a model by the Buddha himself, is to go on alms round. That is to take the alms bowl, to go from house to house, just standing quietly in front of each house a few minutes, waiting until people will come out, and then if they wish to offer the food, they will offer food into the bowl of the monk. And then a third way is for lay people to invite the monastics to come to the house for a meal. And usually, well, from a worldly monastic way of thinking, it's when you get the invitation to the meal that sort of the mind lights up. Ah, delicious food today! Don't have to go from house to house, wedding, you're subject to the heat of the sun, maybe abuse, get away from here, you bald-headed beggar. And then maybe you're getting just leftover food from the day before. And even when people bring food to the monastery, they might just cook in a rather casual and routine way. But when people invite the monks to the house, they usually make special effort to prepare the most delicious food with the greatest diversity and rich in flavors. And so those monks who give a lot of attention to the food that they like will make effort to get invitations to the houses for the meals. Whereas those who want to uphold the ascetic ideal will deliberately refuse to accept invitations and insist on always going on alms round, except if they're sick, then they will remain at the monastery and either fellow monks who go on alms round will share the food with them, or lay people can bring to the monastery to provide the food.
Could this by any chance be a follower of Mahavira or someone else?
Excuse me?
Could he be a follower of Mahavira?
Who?
Bakula.
No.
Coming into our sutras? Because practice is not having clothes and all these things.
No.
Against Buddha's feet.
No. First, he didn't say that. There's nothing that says he didn't wear clothes. No, I mean, this was a practice that Mahavira
shown as just one trait, right?
I think Mahavira was a negative ascetic.
Yeah, negative ascetic. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. So could it be that some of that stuff has got mixed up with
it? I wouldn't say that it's mixed up, because you know there's a lot of testimony that Bakula was an arahat and he's esteemed by in the Sangha, and at least according to the records of this Sutta, the commentaries, it all confirmed that he was a disciple of the Buddha. But I'd say that this, his behavior sort of reflects the spirit that also was underlying the Jain practices and other practices of the period.
I'm just kind of wondering about invited to lay on. I mean, it sounds like the sutta is going to keep going.
Yeah, let's hold that question off to the end. So let me continue so that we can complete the sutta. Okay, so he's never given rise to the thought, may somebody invite me to a meal. He's never even entered a house. You know, sometimes lay people might invite the monks not to a meal, but to come into the house, either to recite the blessings or to receive a cup of tea. I don't know that they had tea in the time of the Buddha, but to accept some refreshment in the afternoon. So he's never even sat down inside a house and never even eaten a meal inside a house. And again, this is, the reciters say, we remember this too as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Venerable Bakula. Okay, now we have a number of suttas, a number of passages referring to Venerable Bakula's relationships with women, which are all pretty much in the negative. In the 80 years since I went forth, I do not recall ever having grasped at the signs and features of a woman. This means, you know, perceiving a woman, sort of, you know, grasping at signs and features of beauty. This ties up with the sensual perception. But then he goes further. He's never taught the Dhamma to a woman, even as much as a four-line stanza. Should I take that?
Just
charged. Excuse me?
Guilty as charged. You are. No, you are guilty as charged because you didn't talk to a woman, right?
Okay, so he's never taught even a four-line stanza. He's never gone to the bhikkhuni's quarters and never taught the Dhamma to a bhikkhuni, that's a fully ordained nun, to a female probationer, that's one who's a sort of in the intermediate stage between novice and fully ordained bhikkhuni, and never taught the Dhamma to a samaneri, that's a woman novice. And so, this was one of the practices that the Buddha had laid down for the Sangha of bhikkhus, that because the living quarters of the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis were separate, and the bhikkhus had, of course, as males, they had more direct access to the Buddha, and so they would get to listen to many more discourses from the Buddha than the nuns would get to hear. And so the Buddha laid down a rule that on the Uposatha day, we call the Poya day, that's the day of the full moon and the new moon, one of the senior bhikkhus, the more learned bhikkhus, would be assigned to go to the bhikkhuni's quarters and to teach, give a Dhamma teaching to the bhikkhunis together with the, what's here called the probationers or the trainees and the novice nuns. And this is called the bhikkhuni ovada, the instruction to the bhikkhunis. And generally the elder learned monks would rotate in that responsibility. So Venerable Ananda took on that job quite often. And then you'll see that there's a sutta later on in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is a discourse given by the monk Nandaka to the bhikkhunis called the Nandakovada Sutta. But Bakula, perhaps when the monk said, Bhante Bakula, would you like to go over to the bhikkhunis and give them the discourse today? Not my practice. Okay, but don't think he was biased exclusively against women, because he says in the next group of statements, In the 80 years since I went forth, I do not recall ever having given the going forth, ever having given the full admission. I'll first read, then I'll have to explain these terms. Ever having given dependence, ever having had a novice wait on me. Okay, the going forth, or pabaja, that is the novice ordination, where you, a senior monk, gives a candidate for ordination, he gives him the 10 precepts of a novice monk. Then the full admission is the, well, I think it's better translated, full ordination. So that would be, you know, to give him the full ordination as a bhikkhu. That is done by a community of monks, presided over by a preceptor. Then having given the dependence, that means that according to the rules of regulations of the Vinaya, one who receives the full ordination during the first 5 years has to live in dependence on or under the guidance of a senior monk. And similarly for a nun, I think it's 3 years, 2 years or 3 years guidance for a junior nun, because she spends 2 years as a probationer. So then I think it's 3 years of dependence or guidance for a junior nun. And then having had a novice wait on him, that has taken a novice as his personal attendant. So Venerable Bakula seems to have been a very solitary type of monk who didn't want to have close relationship with the other monks. Okay, then come another series of passages which again sort of reinforce the idea of the ascetic temperament of Bakula. Okay, in the 80 years since I went forth, I do not recall ever having bathed in a bathhouse, ever having bathed with bath powder. Okay, so it doesn't mean that he never took a bath. You know, that would be quite offensive, I think, for other people. And also, after 80 years, his body would have been covered with dust and dirt and mud and dry and mixed with sweat. But what's so funny?
It's like he doesn't need a cup.
Doesn't need a robe. But there would be at least two ways to take baths. One, many of the monasteries would have a bathhouse in which they would fill a kind of tub with water, and then they would heat up the water, and then you go to the bathhouse and you bathe there. The other way is to go down to a river, a creek, a pond, and bathe, or to a well and bathe there. So apparently, Venerable Bakula would only go to rivers and ponds and creeks to bathe, not using the bathhouse, the convenient bathhouse at the monastery. And then bath powder would be, nowadays, of course, we use soap. In those days, I think soap was invented maybe in the 19th century, 18th or 19th century. But they would use some kind of powder, fragrant powder that they would smash. Well, powder is already fragments. But they would take the powder and then use it to bathe themselves. It would be the equivalent of soap today. So he must have used, I don't know, to get sweat and dirt off. Maybe just clay or whatever was around. Okay, he never would give a massage to his fellow monks. And now this is Raihi, who is said to be the monk foremost in good health. He never had any affliction, as any kind of illness, arise in him, even for the time it takes to milk a cow. He's never carried medicine around, even so much as a piece of gallnut. A gallnut, this is what they call aralu in Sri Lanka. It's a kind of small fruit which is dried, and then it has certain medicinal properties. For its use for upset stomach, constipation, fevers, maybe?
You said aralu?
It's aralu, yeah.
It's used in the Ayurvedic medicine.
Yeah, it's a very common ingredient in the Ayurvedic medicine. Okay, he's never used a bolster. That would be something to prop up his body when he's sitting on the bed. He doesn't recall ever having made up a bed. Well, I think I come close to... And I remember one of my students once said, what is the reason for making up the bed when one is just going to go back to sleep in it the next night?
I leave mine like that too.
Excuse me?
I don't do mine, I just leave it like that, take off.
Yeah. You just leave it the way it is when you wake up, and then it's already unfolded when you're ready to go to sleep. You don't have to cover up the sheet and then pull it down again.
This is a noble quality.
So I guess some of us can pride ourselves on having a wonderful and marvelous quality. Okay, then he never recalls entering a residence for the rains in a dwelling inside a village. And so during the rains period, when it's raining for the 3 months, the Buddha has laid down the rule that the monks have to stop their wandering during this period, and they have to take up a fixed residence. They have to live in a place where they'll have a roof over their head to protect themselves from the rain. And so they could live either in a forest monastery or in a village monastery. And so Bakula says that he's never stayed inside a village, never inside a village monastery, never accepting the invitation from lay people to spend the rains retreat in their house. Sometimes lay people will build a little cottage or a hut on their property inside the village, and they'll invite the monk to stay there. But he's never done that. He's always stayed in the forest during the rains retreat. Okay, then finally, paragraph 38, Bakula makes, sort of concludes this part of the discourse with his declaration of arahatship. He says, for 7 days after going forth, I ate the country's alms food as a debtor. On the 8th day, final knowledge or liberating knowledge arose. Okay, what is meant by eating the alms food as a debtor? Okay, so this is an idea that comes down, that gets elaborated in the commentaries, that, you see, the word arahat literally, well, it comes from the verb arahati, which means to be worthy, to be deserving. And it's used, sort of the root idea is that one is worthy of the offerings of people. So what really makes one worthy to receive the offerings is that one has achieved liberating knowledge, one has eliminated all the defilements, one has gained liberation from the cycle of birth and death. But until one reaches that attainment, when we receive the offerings of people, robes, alms food, living quarters, medicines, other offerings, We're doing so as a debtor. Sort of, we're not really fully worthy of the offerings yet, but they're supporting us in, on the principle that we have entered the practice that leads to this attainment. But to make ourselves fully worthy, we have to reach the goal. And so, as long as we are still have ignorance, defilements, deluded ideas and views in the mind, we are debtors, indebted to the lay people who make the offerings to us. But it's when one gains liberation that one becomes entitled, fully entitled to the offerings. And so Bakula says that after he became a monk, he had to practice just for 7 days. Then on the 8th day, he achieved the goal. So now he's 80 years, he's been an arahat. Okay, so now the monk, the reciters all declare this as a wonderful quality of Venerable Bakula. Okay, then comes a certain stock passage when somebody is very impressed by the teaching and then they want to go forth. So here the naked ascetic Kassapa says that he wants to receive the going forth in this dhamma and discipline. He wants to receive the full ordination. Then he receives the going forth and he receives the full ordination. Of course, not from Venerable Bakula, but Venerable Bakula probably would have pointed him to the nearby monastery, and Achela Kassapa would have gotten the ordination there. And then he dwells alone, diligent, ardent, withdrawn, resolute, and he achieves the final goal, arahatship. That's a little sort of detour from the main part of the sutta. But now, paragraph 40, we return to the account of Venerable Bakula. And it says, then on a later occasion, the Venerable Bakula took a key and went from dwelling to dwelling, that's in the monastery where he's staying, and he says, come out, Venerable Sirs, today I shall attain final Nibbana. So this is a particular ability that occurs to some, well, not only arhats, but even advanced, very accomplished meditators, that they can know the time, the day and time that they're going to pass away. That just occurs to them in their meditation, and they can announce it beforehand. And so Bakula must have become aware that that particular day and such a time, his sort of life-sustaining karma, which had carried him through 160 years, was now about to become exhausted. And so he wants the other monks to come to witness his passing away. And so then Venerable Bakula, seated in the midst of the Sangha of Bhikkhus, he attained final Nibbana. Yeah, according to the commentary, Venerable Bakula, because his lifestyle was very simple and not demanding on others, he didn't want to leave the other monks with the burden of having to take care of his cremation. So when he passed away, in the process of passing away, what he did was to enter into meditation on the fire kasina. And using the fire kasina, that is the sort of visualizing fire as his object, he directed that fire towards his body and had his whole body burn up right after he passed away, and so there would be no corpse remaining behind. The body just was reduced to ashes, and then the ashes settled on the ground and nothing else was left. And so then the monks, all the compilers of the discourse, say that seated in the midst of the Sangha of Bhikkhus, the Venerable Bhakkhula attained final Nibbana. This too we remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Venerable Bhakkhula. Okay, that's the discourse. What do you make of Prabhu?
As you said at the beginning, Bhante, this is not something that the Buddha himself preached. So to me, I will take a pinch of salt, so to say, you know, because it is not that the Buddha, it is not.
Yeah, I don't know that that is on, because I don't.
It was just a test.
There's a mute control. It might have been pressed.
No, it's on.
It's on? Okay.
Can you hear me now?
I could hear you, but I'm thinking about the people in the back.
Okay. This is, normally as you said, the sutra started, eva me sutang eva
yeah.
So man bhagava, sabhatyam, that's how I heard that such and such great
yeah.
Buddha discourse. But this, as you said, this did not start that way.
Yeah.
Because it is something that Bhakkhula is being questioned by someone else.
Yeah.
So to me, I take a pinch of salt. Thank
you. Okay. Edwin? I thought that was Edwin had the hand up.
He says that in the eighth day, he got all actually, let me get back to he got final knowledge on the eighth day. Then again, he went to Nirvana, which I understand Nirvana, but final knowledge will be Bodhisattva?
No, the final knowledge is the attainment of arhatship.
So when he goes out at the end, he says he reaches a Paranibbana. So what would be the difference?
Oh, you see, when he attains final knowledge, he still continues to live on. In fact, he's lived on now for 80 years. Mm-hmm. But through the attainment of final knowledge, he's eradicated all the defilements. So now he's fully liberated in mind. But his vital energy, the vital force, is still sufficient to keep him alive in good health for 80 years. So he continues to live on for 80 years. Then when he's 160, then the vital energy declines and then he passes away.
But I just want to see the difference on both. Even if it's not him, on the word is, because I thought it would be the same thing.
No. The final knowledge marks the attainment of Nibbana while alive. And then what is called here, the attainment of final Nibbana, means the passing away into Nibbana. The passing away without any residue of bodily existence.
Thanks.
Okay, I think Stacy had some comment, or maybe Chris, you have it? You?
Stacy. Oh. No, I was just saying before that he seemed
to speak loud.
He seemed to lack the compassion to use the lay people's offerings.
Yeah, in fact, there is a sutta that comes in the Anguttara Nikaya, where the Buddha speaks about four types of, he says that there are four types of persons living in the world. So what are the four? The one who lives for his own good and the good of others. The one who lives for his own good but not the good of others. The one who lives for the good of others, but not for his own good, and the one who lives for the good of neither himself nor of others. And then the Buddha says, of the four types, of these four types of persons, the one who is the best, he uses a whole series of terms, the best, the foremost, the most excellent, the supreme, is the one who lives for his own good and the good of others. And so it seems that the ideal that the Buddha sort of posited for the Sangha is to live, of course, for one's own good, because one has to cultivate the practice oneself in order to purify oneself and to illuminate one's own mind with wisdom, but also to work for the benefit of others, particularly in the case of the monastics, by sharing the Dhamma with others. But Bakula seems to be sort of the model, almost carried to an extreme, of one who lives for his own good, but at least not explicitly for the good of others. Venerable Sagarakantu, if you can either speak loudly or take the microphone, which is, or come up to the front.
Just a quick point. In this sutra, it describes a person who's not an arahant who accepts the alms food as a debtor, right?
Yeah.
But and there's another sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Purification of Alms Food.
Yeah.
What's the name of that sutra?
I think it's called Pindapata Parisuddhi Sutta.
And in that sutra, the Buddha says for a bhikkhu to be worthy of the alms food, he has to have a finger snap of loving kindness.
Oh, that's actually a very good point. That's a very, very good point. Was it in that sutta? I haven't looked at that in a long time. But there are like a whole series of suttas that come in the Anguttara Nikaya, the Book of Ones, where the Buddha says that a monk who develops, it could be loving kindness, each of the Brahma Viharas, loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, equanimity, mindfulness of breathing, recollection of the Buddha, Dhamma Sangha, mindfulness of breathing, any of the meditation objects, even for the time of a finger snap, is, I think it said that he's worth, he doesn't eat the alms food in vain, I think that's what's said, which is a little different from eating from not eating it as a debtor. One is still a debtor, but one is not eating it in vain. It's still fruitful for the people who make the offerings. In fact, one has to sort of balance these two against one another. Because if one says that one is not fully worthy unless one is an arhat, then we don't have any lay supporters. They all turn their backs. But if the monk or nun cultivates any of these practices, even for this much, then they eat the alms food not in vain. In other words, it's beneficial for those who make the offerings. Just, and did you get to speak? You did, that's right. I just want, before we close, we could continue this discussion after the meal. I just wanted to point out that my former student, now leading scholar, Bhikkhu Anālayo, he has this book called Madhyama Agama Studies, in which he's studying suttas from the Chinese Madhyama Agama in relationship to their Pali counterparts. And he has a paper or an essay on the Bakula Sutta, and he makes some interesting comments here. I just wanted to read a few passages from this paper before we close. Well, he says that the Bakula Sutta, which is evidently a later discourse, might testify to a stage in the development of the conception of an arahat, where the earlier, more altruistic ideal was gradually being replaced by a growing emphasis on austere external conduct, the shift of perspective during which the arahat's detachment becomes increasingly understood as a form of indifference, then he compares Bakula with the Venerable Mahakasapa, who also exhibits that austere ascetic temperament, but Mahakasapa would give discourses to the monks, and he praised the monk who is himself sort of accomplished in the ascetic practices and also encourages others to observe them. But in contrast, the Venerable Bakula doesn't encourage other monks to engage in any of the practices. So then Venerable Anālaya says, in the examples that we just surveyed, Mahakasapa does take an active interest in community matters and also acts as a teacher. He even goes to a nunnery to teach the nuns, even though this was done at the instigation of Ananda. And so in contrast to Bakula, Mahakasapa would not have been able to proclaim that he never entered a nunnery, that he never greeted a nun, or that he never taught a nun. And then he says, since the depiction of Bakula must stem from a period some distance after the Buddha's passing away, it seems reasonable to assume that the praises bestowed on him in the Bakula Sutta testify to a development in the conception of an arahat subsequent to the earlier ideal of the arahat reflected in the other early discourses. In fact, as the comparison with Mahakasapa shows, in other early discourses, the austerity and the ascetic conduct do not require from teaching activities. In sum, it seems that the arhat ideal evident in the depiction of Bakula reflects tendencies that can already be seen in some discourses related to Mahakasapa, probably representing an attitude held among a faction of the early Buddhist community. If Bakula's fellow monks had adopted a type of conduct similar to those praised in this discourse, the Buddhist monastic order would not have stood much chance of surviving. Okay, maybe with this we'll end for the day, and then we will come back, let us say, at, let's say 12:30, and then we could have discussion then. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. Hey, maybe you guys share the merits. Maybe I'll leave without sharing. I've been so inspired. But did Venerable Bakula, perhaps Venerable Bakula, for all we know, you know, he might have been not teaching in the human realm, but radiating his merits to the Deva world and the realm of the pretas.
At the age of 80 or 160, I mean, everyone would be a whole person, I'm sure, because most of our desires would be gone. Our physical changes.
Yeah. Okay, so let us recite the verses for sharing the merits. Akasa ta jabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva shiram rakantu sasanam akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumoditva shiram rakantu desanam akasata jabumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantam Anumodipa Chiram Rakantu Mang Param Eta Vatacham Hehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Devanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Eta Vatacham Hehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Eta vatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya vichihetato etantare satakayupapana rupi arupicha asanya sanino dukha pamuchantu Bhusanto Nibhutin.